Hi, I'm Todd McDonald, regional host of All Things Considered. Prairie Public is here for you as you search for answers on how to navigate your life during these times of uncertainty through special news coverage, in the music, and in the delightful programs that provide respite, or in the familiar voices offering daily companionship on your radio, online, your smart speaker, or smartphone apps. Please ensure this vital service remains strong by supporting Prairie Public. Support this station you count on at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now by phone is UND Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs once a month right here on Prairie Public, including coming up this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
It's nice to talk to someone out of my cave hiding from the virus like everyone else, you know? It's good to hear your voice.
Well, yeah, you know, one of the funnier memes I saw on social media, which may have even come from you, is somebody saying, so you're telling me the guy who can't stop autoplay on YouTube is now going to be teaching online for the rest of the semester?
It has been an adventure, I will say that. And actually, one of the great lessons, which thankfully I did not have to learn, is that a lot of professors are being caught with questionable open tabs on their browsers when they screen share. So it's there's a little level of humanity that the students are experiencing that they have not before.
All joking aside, the coronavirus or COVID-19 is a very serious topic, and many people are doing shelter in place. Many more people are also fighting on the front lines of this, whether you are the checkout worker at a grocery store or you're delivering on Amazon or you are being a first responder medically or a police officer. What is the theme of this month's show?
The theme of the show is, what is the role of philosophy in all of this? We have this vision of crises and tragedies when people act on instinct, people act on feeling, people act selfishly, and there isn't a lot of room for forethought. And so the question, it was actually suggested by a friend of mine, is does philosophy have a role in times of global crisis? And is there a way and is there a place for us to be reflective about this without at the same time ignoring the necessities that come before us?
Right, which isn't very easy to do, of course, having foresight. I mean, there's a reason they say hindsight is 2020, and they don't
right.
have that expression about foresight. Walk us through the highlights of this conversation.
Well, so my guest is a woman named Susan Neiman, who's in Germany, and she's a very interesting woman. She was born Jewish in Atlanta, Georgia, during the civil rights movement. She was a member of an Atlanta temple that was famously firebombed, and she was alive when that happened. Went to grad school and all that kind of stuff at Yale, but then lived in Tel Aviv and now lives in Germany. And so she has the experience of being both an outsider and an insider in a lot of different communities. And her work really circles around this main question. She looks at the role of evil in the world and whether or not you can still use that terminology. She looks at what it means to be an adult. She looks at what it means to have moral clarity. And so we use these insights to sort of investigate the nature of thinking about things while we're doing them and also trying to assess our own values, right? And that's one of the things that she really remains consistent on, both in our conversation and through her work, that one of our goals is to maintain and act on our values during the crisis. So if we consider ourselves good people, we want to be good people during the crisis. There's a simple question that we've all asked in one form or another that is actually a fairly deep philosophical question, but people don't recognize it as such, which is it immoral to order pizza during the coronavirus, right? You are asking someone who is often a minimum wage worker to go to work and then to go to everyone's houses and encounter strangers. On the one hand, you're giving them a job, which is really important. But on the other hand, you're exposing them to virus in a way that lots of other people aren't exposed. And that's actually a really deep philosophical question. So that's the kind of thing that we were talking about. Where do you see the philosophy in the everyday debates and everyday discussions that we're having while we're facing this pandemic?
Well, when you talk about living a value-driven life, what about at a time like this, do we change our values?
That is one of the great historical questions. The Greek historian Thucydides talks about a plague in Athens about 2,500 years ago, and it killed 25% of the population, almost 100,000 people in one city. And his assertion is that all law broke down. People rejected morality, they rejected the police, and that people acted at their worst. And this story, even if you don't know the name Thucydides, this follows us everywhere in our culture. Every mini series, right? You know, The Walking Dead, every movie. It all assumes that when there's a tragedy, that society collapses. But I don't think that that's what's happening around the world. And as North Dakotans, as more cases pop up in our immediate vicinity, we can ask, are North Dakotans acting like North Dakotans? Are we living the life that we speak about, that we try to aim for every day, or have we become radically different? And I don't personally, and Susan doesn't in her, you know, region, see people acting radically different, even though our day-to-day rhythms are quite different.
Well, it sort of sounds a little bit like people who are watching a lot of news and they feel very afraid of going to places because what you see, and this is outside of the COVID-19 context here, but when you see shootings, when you see fires, when you see crimes, but statistically speaking, it's actually a very safe time to be alive. But what has changed is the consumption of that media. And so when you're talking about this philosopher, and yes, we did see people hoarding toilet paper. We saw empty shelves. Heck, even outside of a tragedy, we see this on Black Friday. But in your discussion with Susan, you talk about the behavior that you are seeing. And in a lot of ways, this episode struck me as one of your most hopeful.
I'm really glad you feel that way. And the Black Friday example is a great example because the thing about Black Friday is there are no consequences if you fail, right? If you don't get the big screen TV, yeah, you don't get the big screen TV, but your life isn't over. Maybe you don't get as nice a gift as you would otherwise for Christmas. But in COVID-19, everything matters. And everything matters very seriously with very serious consequences. And so everyone is acting really on their best behavior. Now, not everyone is acting. And it's very easy to find the example of the kids in spring break or the neighbor who has the coronavirus party. But the reason why these are news is that almost everyone else is not doing it. And so one of the things that the conversation highlighted and one of the things that Susan really brought out was the fact that the more things matter, the more people behave. And the less things matter, the more we can act willy-nilly. And so this idea that we are afraid of the world, but we're not afraid of our neighborhood is really important. You used that example of crime statistics. Also, if you ask Americans what they think of the American school system, they'll say the nastiest stuff about it. But if you ask Americans what they think about the school where their kids go to, they almost always love the school. Mm-hmm. And it's that same thing. It's the big picture affected by media, affected by social network, affected by our all natural anxieties. That makes the world seem like a very scary place. But if you ask, well, do you trust your neighbor? When you walk down the street, do you feel safe? Are the dog owners acting responsibly? Do people give you 6 feet of wiggle room when you're on the greenway? Then for the most part, people are fairly optimistic and fairly trusting.
How has the COVID-19 pandemic changed the way that you are teaching, besides the fact that you're stuck doing it online versus in a classroom?
Well, that's a hard question because on the one hand, the way that I've always described it is in my classroom, I try to give my students a philosophical experience. But online, where I record videos and they have sort of correspondence style classes, it's much more about information transfer. So the very idea is, the very sort of pedagogical goal is different. But at the same time, there's something very nice about it in that it has forced me to be much more thoughtful and much more anticipatory about my courses in a way that I can take for granted. I've been in the classroom since 1991. Spring 1991 was the first class I ever taught. I was actually a senior in college, and I taught an honors seminar, supervised by a professor because I was still an undergraduate. And so, you know how to do my job, and I can walk into the class, and I can turn it on, and I can become Dr. Jack, right, and have my voice and bring the students out and all of that kind of stuff. But I can't do that on the computer in the same way. Even my Prairie Public experience and Y Radio experience, it's not the same thing because I have the Prairie Public team that helps me out and we have all these structures and it's still live in many respects. But teaching now, everything has to be planned out in advance and everything has to be anticipated. That's against my spontaneous personality, but it also forces me to ask, what are my goals? What are my values? And how do I retain my teaching values in the face of the coronavirus, just as I have to ask, how do I retain my moral values or my civic values as I walk down the street or as I offer assistance to my neighbors or if I ask for help, which I've had to do as well.
People are saying a silver lining in this is it's a great time for personal reinvention because it's very easy to go on autopilot when you take the same route to work, you see the same people, you throw on that Dr. Jack persona, and you don't have to encounter new information very much. And so you're not necessarily learning. And I wonder, as a society, how do you and Susan tackle the conversation of societal reinvention in the wake of a pandemic?
I think the key is to think about it in exactly the terms that you just described, which is societal intervention, as opposed to productivity, right? There's a lot of pressure, you know, oh, well, I'm home now for a month. I get to learn Spanish, or
learning sourdough bread.
Right. There's this obsession, right? And I'm a hobbyist baker, so I understand the wonderful value of sourdough bread. But Americans are obsessed with sourdough bread, and it's very, very weird.
It takes a lot of time, but not very much effort. It's a great pandemic activity.
it is, but here's the problem. When you think in terms of productivity, you don't give yourself the chance to grieve. You don't give yourself the chance to reflect. Americans are not particularly good at leisure. What do we do on our off time? We work out, right? Americans, worse than most other places in the world, certainly in Europe and Africa and South and Central America, they have a much more robust notion of leisure time, of slow conversations during dinner and all of these sorts of things. And so one of the things that people are doing, which is really wonderful, is they're communicating with one another in ways that they wouldn't have done during a normal weekday. They have virtual happy hours. Yesterday was the first night of Passover. And in the first night of Passover, you're supposed to have big dinners with lots of people and engage in this religious ritual. And Jews all around the world are doing virtual seders. They're connecting with FaceTime and Zoom to invite their entire synagogue or their entire family to their dinner table. And so on the one hand, Jews historically have had 5 or 6 or 7 people at their family seder. Now people are having 30-person seders. Right.
Yeah.
And so this, there is that sense of connectedness. There is this sense of making the effort to find out who's important to you, to touch base, and to be slower and more intentional about your life, the way that I am slower and more intentional about my teaching. And if we can walk away from this pandemic with reminding ourselves the value of friendship, the value of interpersonal contact, the value of reflecting on our own lives and commitments, then that will be a tremendous accomplishment. Not to mention, and Susan spends a fair amount of time talking about this too, if we can walk away making the world a better place politically for people who need it, right? I mentioned the pizza delivery person earlier. Maybe now that we know that pizza delivery is an essential service, now that we know that the person who is the cash register in our grocery store is an essential service, maybe we'll end up giving them higher salaries. Maybe we'll end up giving them better health care, right? What this has done, and I don't want to get partisan here, but what this has done is exposed the flaws in the American system in terms of what we need as workers and what we need as human beings. And so how do we come out of this and remember the lessons that we learn and make this not worthwhile, because it'll never be worthwhile to have lost all of these people and to have had so many people suffer, but to say, okay, we're going to walk away from this a better society, a better world, and better people, because we're not going to forget the lessons that it taught us. And that's where philosophy becomes really important, because philosophy allows us to plan the future and then to work to achieve that plan.
Briefly, what's going to be the future of The Why Show? You had to do this one by yourself without access to the normal radio studio that you have, and you did a great job over Zoom. Is that your plan moving forward?
That is our plan. All of your listeners should know that radio studios across the world are shut down tight. Everyone at Prairie Public is working 10 times as hard to bring these things to you. The same for me. And I have the next 3-4 months planned, and I'm just going to keep getting better at the technology. And hopefully, since it's just me and I don't have an engineer, hopefully I won't mess it up too bad and I'll get the interviews to you. And if I mess it up, then I'm just not going to tell anybody.
This month's Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, airs Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. There's always bonus content on the podcast. And that's at whyradioshow.org. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, thanks for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Ashley.
Coming up next, Tom Ezern.
Many nonprofit organizations in our region are facing daunting challenges during the COVID-19 crisis due to canceled events and reduced donations. Dakota Medical Impact and Alex Stern Family Foundations have established a temporary giving platform where regional charities can list their urgent needs in light of COVID-19. You can access the crisis response platform at dmfhelpinghearts.org to learn about critical needs and help out. That website again is dmfhelpinghearts.org. This message was brought to you by Prairie Public and the Dakota Medical Impact and Alex Stern Family Foundations.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And of course, during COVID-19, we are doing socializing a little differently, maintaining a good 6 feet distance or doing a lot more online. Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he takes us back to socializing in a different way, a box social.
School term had not yet commenced, but there was a crowd late one Friday evening in August 1885 at a country schoolhouse 3 miles north of Drayton, North Dakota. The box social convened that night was, according to the Pembina Pioneer Express, an unqualified success. By 7 o'clock, the house was well filled with old and young from the neighborhood, wrote the local correspondent, and the Drayton people came thick and fast until there was not a square inch of standing room to let, and crowds were gracefully grouped around the open doors and the windows. Pause a moment and picture this gathering. I imagine farm families arrayed in their best but by no means stylish attire, mingling with business and professional folk from town noticeable in the mix. Thronging the little country schoolhouse, Americana of the most democratic sort. People came from miles around because the box social, sometimes called a basket social, was still a new thing in Dakota Territory. There were several that I know of in 1883, including one that May at a residence in Pembina. A box supper at a residence, however, was not exactly right according to custom. And last week I recounted how an early basket social put on by the Methodist Ladies of Jamestown also was a little off, inasmuch as they did not incorporate the common element of romance. The Drayton gang got it right. "Every gentleman got a box," says our correspondent, "and soon found its owner, in spite of the oft-repeated slander that there are no girls in Dakota." Well, there you have it. Sociability and community are great things, but in the middle of this affair, boy meets girl, or lady, as the case may be. Of course, the account continues, some of them were married girls, but they evidently wished they were young again as they chatted gaily with their youthful escorts, while boys, with a sprinkling of gray in their beards, looked almost bashful as they gallantly presented themselves to blushing maidens. There was lots of fun, and each gentleman was sure he got the best supper in the house. Keeping things respectable, a literary program followed the supper, and after that, a missionary from Manitoba gave an encouraging address to Sunday school workers. Sunday school students, under the direction of Miss Hallcrow, gave recitations. Mr. Van Camp played the dulcimer. Grandma Summers sang a solo, upon which an encore was demanded. Captain Thompson, Miss Thompson, and Mr. George and Herbert Thompson formed a stalwart quartet, accompanied on the organ by Miss Spinning, to conclude the program. As the custom of the box social developed in Dakota Territory over the next few years, the northeastern counties were ground zero of the bidding for boxes. The Pembina Pioneer Express, the Botno Pioneer, and the Langdon Courier Democrat were all spangled with notices and reports of box socials in schools, church basements, community halls, and other public venues. As soon as box or basket socials became routine, the reporting of them devolved into that special section of the country newspaper known as the locals. So when the citizens of Joliet decided to have a box social in their schoolhouse to be followed by a lecture in which Reverend J.G. Moore would expound on Pompeii and the eruption of Vesuvius, the announcement appeared in the Joliet column of the Pembina paper. Such doings were thus recorded for history, a history I will reflect upon in future essays.
Maybe we can figure out how to do box socials on Zoom. Still to come on Main Street, Sue Balcom teaches us how to plant by the moon cycles. And we have a movie review from Matt O'Lean. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Plans to handle what could be a surge in the number of COVID-19 patients in coming weeks in North Dakota. We have identified the city-owned Fargo Dome as a field hospital. It would handle the overflow of patients at Sanford and Essentia hospitals in Fargo. Here's Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney.
We look for ways of bringing beds into the community to the hospitals, so Sanford could take let's say 100 beds, and I think that Essentia was going to take 100 beds. So that's a way of increasing surge capacity. But we've got the turf up, so the Fargo Dome would be an alternative for surge planning, and that's what the Corps identified and went through the buildings.
Mahoney says nearby dormitories on the NDSU campus would be used to house medical providers and provide food service to both patients and medical personnel at the Fargo Dome. A similar plan is underway to use the University of Mary Fieldhouse in Bismarck. Dismal, that's how North Dakota Aeronautics Commission Executive Director Kyle Warner describes the state of air travel in North Dakota and around the country because of COVID-19.
We saw a 43% decline in the amount of passengers for the month of March in comparison to last March. 46,000 passenger drop. We expect that to further drop moving forward now into April and In the near term, we're estimating, you know, our airports and the airports around the country, they're at about 5% to 10% of the normal passenger loads.
Wanner says prior to March, North Dakota's airports were doing very well.
February was the best February on record in North Dakota. So we were actually anticipating 2020 to probably be a record-breaking year for passenger numbers, which obviously is not the case anymore. And so we're hopeful that we can work hard to get our airports back to where they were before this virus hit.
Wanner says that will take some time to ramp up once things return to normal.
You know, it's not going to be a light switch where you know, all of a sudden people start traveling again to where they were prior to this virus hitting.
Wanner says the airlines are doing a good job of working with passengers who had to cancel flights, even if they did not purchase travel insurance. And the 2020 flood on the Red River is already a top 10 event in Grand Forks and East Grand Forks. If the river bounces up to 48 feet, as predicted on Friday, it would tie for the sixth highest crest of all time. In fact, six of the top 10 floods have occurred since the year 2006. In the northern end of the Red River Valley, the city of Oslo, Minnesota, is fluctuating just under 38 feet. Drayton is projected to reach 42.3 feet next week, which is a major flood stage there is 42 feet. And Pembina is expected to top out at 48.8. Major flood stage there is 49 feet. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is root seller Sue. Sue, thanks for joining us.
I am happy to be here. This is a great distraction from all the other things that I'm doing these days to keep busy.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week for Main Street Eats. She, of course, runs the Root Cellars Farm just outside of Mandan alongside her husband. And Sue, you sent me a little cheat sheet about things to talk about this week, and it says planting by the moon. And I am a very literal person, and so my thought was like, oh, she's actually going outside when it's in the middle of the night and planting these things? And I was like, oh, she means moon cycles, doesn't she?
Although I have heard of some instances where people actually do go out when the moon is full and do some planting. Because weed seeds don't germinate in moonlight because it's not direct sunlight. So anytime you disturb your soil and you kick up a weed seed in the brilliant, beautiful sun, then you get a weed out of the deal. So if you're outside in the moonlight, those seeds will not germinate, according to what I've heard. The best thing to keep the weeds away, of course, is to ground cover with lots of mulch, paper and or grass or whatever thing that is. But yes, there are people who believe that you should plant according to the moon cycles. And I think it's actually called the strawberry moon in April, if I remember my folklore correctly. So I want you all to make sure that you go find a video or get outside and see, watch the moon this summer. It's going to be an amazing thing.
It always is.
Yes, I love the moon. I love to stand in the moonlight. I read in the moonlight. Part of this whole thing is that the moon has an effect on us and the earth, as you probably have experienced in your own life.
Yeah, a little bit.
Feeling blue, or sometimes you just don't know what's the matter with you.
I actually have a lot more energy during a full moon.
See, I do too. I feel my energy ebbs and flows with the cycles of the moon. And I think that's
true
about a lot of
people. I like to say I sleep when the moon sleeps.
Right, me too, because otherwise it's just too exciting. And so my husband harasses me about these kinds of things to no end. It's kind of like when I document the fog days in the fall. And then 90 days from fog, you always have precipitation. So technically, I always try to plant my radishes and my cold crops, onions maybe, things like that, in my raised beds right before the first rain in the spring. And that's usually sometime in April, because April showers bring May flowers. But he just doesn't believe that fog begets rain and or snow. But I can prove it because I keep a diary. And as you know, before meteorologists and or weathermen and or televisions, farmers knew their land like the back of their hand. They were aware of the microclimate areas on their property. They were aware of how signs in nature kind of dictated storms coming and or cold weather, maybe frosts and things like that. Now, naturally, we're kind of like at the end of our long, hot summer in weather patterns, according to some of the authors I've read. And so climate change has been changing our growing season up here in North Dakota. And we can't count on things being totally the same anymore, but I still watch the weather and I watch the moon, because that's the one thing you can count on coming up, right? Am I right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so the Farmer's Almanac people have this weather prediction thing that is based on some ancient secret formula that they actually keep locked away. But gardening by the moon... Yeah, it's a weather formula. Seriously, that's how they make their predictions in their almanac. And they also offer up a moon cycle chart that kind of tells you what crops you should plant when, and it's based on the gravitational pull of the moon, which also affects the tides. You know, everybody knows about tides coming in and going out. And so the moon, while it pulls on the waters in the large oceans, also does that in your garden, on your property. So science says that seeds will absorb more water during a full moon and the new moon, when the moisture is actually being pulled to the surface of your soil. You know, the new moon, of course, as you know, is when it's completely dark outside. And it's so bizarre, isn't it, how dark it is when there's no moon? And of course, we all know that full moons, like I said earlier, we've got some super moons coming up this year. One is in April, and I just love when we have blue moons, which is a second full moon in a month. And that's happening more and more and more as I get older and older and older. So I used to write a column about the moon, you know, it waxes and wanes. Mm-hmm. It's got different phases with different names. And one of my favorites is when it's a teeny tiny little skinny crescent, but you can still see the outline of the moon, the old moon in the new moon's arms. It's quite a romantic sight in the sky. So anyway, back to gardening. Sorry, I digress. I just love the moon. Okay, so plants respond to gravity. And you can see that plants have this, and I've always wondered about this. You know, you put I have a vine, a Hoya vine growing in my office. And I did not tell it where the cord to the blinds were. It found that on its own. And it started wrapping around it and growing up. And I'm like, how do plants know about these things? Well, gravity has a large part in that. Geotropism is what it's called. And that's kind of affects how a plant decides to grow and what direction to take as they search out things to climb on and or the way to the surface.
So what is geotropism?
That's a good question. It has something to do with the gravity, the pull of the Earth's gravity. You know, like you can imagine that the core of our Earth, the gravity pulls things down, and that's why we don't float around, which that was a mistake, I think. We should have been able to fly a little bit.
Who's in
right?
charge here?
And so you've got light pulling, you've got gravity from the moon up here, but you've got a really strong sense of gravity here on the planet. So that's what, and I probably didn't explain that like a scientist would explain that, but that's somewhat what that has to do with.
Yeah, I've just called it up here on the iPad, and it just says, the growth of the parts of plants with respect to the force of gravity. The upward growth of the plant shoots is an instance of negative geotropism. The downward growth of the roots is positive geotropism.
Yes, so I knew in my head what I was talking about. Anyway, so roots grow downward and stems grow upwards. So think about your plants. You have some garden vegetables that are actually the root that you eat, and then other ones that you eat the fruit, and that's above ground and below ground. So I know that you've maybe planted an onion or a clove of garlic in the wrong direction. It will not
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, and it won't grow down. It will not grow down. It will make a 90-degree turn in the soil, and it will find its way up to the surface of the soil without fail. Mm. And so
seeds are incredible.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Think about, yeah, being this tiny little capsule that is underground in the dark, and it has to burst through and grow and then turn into something that we either think is beautiful or we can eat, or usually both. Huh.
I know. That's why that's why I sing to my plants, because I know they appreciate it. I know they appreciate it. You know, so it's kind of like you plant your root crops when the moon is pulling the water up, and you plant your other crops when the moon is in between new and full. But you can also plant according to astrology. Now, I'm not a big believer that, you know, my astrological sign will foretell my future or my fortune, but I am an Aries, and if you know me, I'm a little bit hot-headed and ram through life, and so there's some truth to it. But when the moon is in a certain area of the zodiac, there are signs that you can, like right now is the Aries, because I just had a birthday here. March and April is Aries, and you should be harvesting during those times. So I should have probably had my lettuce planted sooner. But, you know, like plant, transplant, or graft during Taurus, Pisces, and Cancer. So Pisces is coming up, I think. So it'd be a good time to plant some above ground crops like lettuce and stuff. Annual fruits, flowers, and vegetables that bear crops above the ground should be planted while the moon waxes. Now, you know that means that the moon is going from a new moon to a full moon. It's growing as it waxes. Now, you want to plant because as the moon grows brighter, leaves and stems actually perk up. But your below ground crops should be planted while the moon is waning so that the energy is put into the bulb underneath the ground. So that I find to be quite fascinating, and I think to be quite true regardless of people who laugh at my folklore. And if you're not a moon gazer by nature, you can go into the stardate.org is a fabulous resource for astrological phenomenon. You know, like if you've noticed something in the sky that's brighter than usual, Jupiter in the past couple months has been incredibly bright. And I don't know why, but I have actually an app on my phone called Sky Guide that you can use to identify constellations if you don't remember them from school, like Cassiopeia and Orion and the Pleiades and all of those things that are above us creating a beautiful night sky.
Sue, this is fascinating.
I know. It's one of my favorite things. I used to write a column, so I always knew what was going on in the sky. And so I think that while you're down there on the ground planting, don't forget to look up once in a while and see what's above you. Give it
a
try
and
let me know how it
Sue.
Works.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week for Main Street Eats. You can also follow her at therootsellers.com.
Stay safe, my friend.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. And this week, Matt, you actually went to a movie or saw a movie that would be in the theaters if we could go to the theaters. Call of the Wild.
Yeah, with Harrison Ford in the adaptation of course, the famous Jack London novel. Now, we were able to access this, Doug, through Amazon, and you pay a price to watch it in your home theater. So Call of the Wild was in theaters when theaters shut down. So this kind of counts as a new release movie. A lot of those are available. The Invisible Man with Elizabeth Moss, that's another one I'd like to see. So we're kind of doing the same thing here, just I didn't see it in the theater. So let me tell you one thing about how our house works, Doug. When our daughter Chloe calls for a family movie night, let's just say she controls the strings, okay? We're not watching stuff that I want to watch. We're watching, eventually she wins the compromise. So she wanted to see Call of the Wild because she'd already seen it in theaters with her grandma. And I thought, well, I can review that then. So that's fine. So that's what we're doing. And thanks to Chloe for Call of the Wild. Now, the director here is Chris Sanders. Now, he has a good track record with animated films, Doug. How to Train Your Dragon, The Croods, Lilo and Stitch. And unfortunately, this feels like an animated movie with real-life actors stuck in and later, dog sleds, teams of dogs are put in, animated, CGI. That's how the film comes off. Now, to actually get dogs, actual real dogs, to do the sledding, which Buck, the main dog, does, he's stolen from his family in California, and he ends up on this ship up to the Yukon to Alaska in the 1890s, where he's a sled dog, and eventually he meets Harrison Ford, who's a gold prospector, and that's the genesis of the story. When it was filmed in 1935 with Clark Gable, they used, real dogs. And now it's simply not done. It's all animated. And I must say, Buck's CGI is cute. It's well done. But he really comes off as a dog that's way too smart for a dog. And I know dogs are smart, but it's almost like he's a person with the CGI. And I didn't really care for the CGI, but I understand this is the way things are done now. Most of the backdrops are CGI too, Doug. It's very disconcerting to watch this movie. There are parts of it I liked, but the CGI is so heavy, Doug, that you just know you're not in Alaska. You're not even close to Alaska. You're probably in a studio where they're going to put CGI in later. So I think that's the inevitable weakness of the film.
Well, you mentioned that the CGI dog, Buck, seemed to have sort of human characteristics. And yep, when I looked into the movie, The Call of the Wild, the 2020 version of it, it's been made several times for television and the big screen. It was a motion capture performer by the name of Terry Notary who played Buck before they added the CGI.
Yeah, it feels like Scooby-Doo, Doug. That's really, when you watch this movie, it really feels like Scooby-Doo with Harrison Ford as John Thornton, the gold prospector. Omar Sy is in this movie. Karen Gillan has a small part, but really it's Buck and Harrison Ford. Dan Stevens, who played the Beast in the Beauty and the Beast remake, he's the cartoonish villain, almost coming off like Snidely Whiplash. Look, I think kids will enjoy this movie. My daughter liked it a lot. I sat and watched the whole thing, but for me, it's like I've talked about, Doug, on this show. If Lawrence of Arabia was made today, the desert would be CGI. It would not have the same impact that it had in 1962 when David Lean and the cast of thousands spent a year in the desert. And what resulted was showmanship and entertainment and a film that people still talk about today. So the funny thing about this, Doug, is the cost of this film was enormous. They need to make about $200 million to just break even on this movie. And so far, it's grossed about, $40 million. That's pretty good considering that theaters got shut down, which was a bad break for this. But CGI is expensive, so it's not like going to CGI is saving a lot of money. But I think the time and the work that would have to be put in to have sled dogs and actual dogs and actual dog interaction with Harrison Ford is probably something they don't want to do these days. So it's a trade-off. It's a catch-22. I didn't really care for the movie, but I think kids may enjoy it if you're stuck at home and want to pay a small fee to watch a theater movie. This is probably the best family movie out there.
Well, when I looked into it, and I inevitably do that when we're talking about a movie. You mentioned Clark Gable, and of course Harrison Ford. Charlton Heston has played the role. Ricky Schroeder has played the role. Rutger Hauer has played the role. Nick Mancuso has played the role. So this Jack London Story, written in 1903, first of all for the Saturday Evening Post, and it was published as a book, was based essentially on things he saw, he witnessed, not necessarily a dog named Buck, but he was in the Yukon during the Gold Rush, and London actually made his writing career out of telling those kinds of stories, like To Build a Fire, that were immensely popular. He became a very handsomely paid writer, coming from a rather modest upbringing and a modest education. He was a self-made man who died rather young at the age of 40 from accumulated diseases and alcoholism.
Yeah, Call of the Wild was one of my dad's favorite books as a boy. And so the book remains one of those kind of young boy, young person type books to read as you see Buck's adventures and things like that. But it's uneasily transferred to screen. And you mentioned all those adaptations, Doug. The Charlton Heston version is supposedly really bad. And it doesn't really transfer to the screen the way the Seawolf does, because the Seawolf, another Jack London story, was really well done in 1941 with Edward G. Robinson as Wolf Larsen. That one transfers pretty well. But anytime you're dealing with animals, I just don't think this film is going to make people forget about Old Yeller, which has an actual dog that you can actually be sentimental with and latch on to. And that's why the ending of that film is so powerful. Not that they actually killed the dog in the making of the movie, but you feel like a real dog who bonded with that boy is now lost.
You know, I remember, Matt, sitting in a theater in Detroit Lakes more than 60 years ago when Old Yeller was a first-run movie, and weeping with the rest of the audience at the end of that movie. That is that was heart-wrenching for a young boy.
I'm sure it was. 1957, I think that came out. And let me just credit Chris Sanders. There is emotion in this movie. You do feel something between Buck and Harrison Ford. There's going to be some emotion. There's going to be some bad times. You know, Buck is abused. He's stolen from his family. So you end up feeling something for this CGI dog. So the film isn't a complete failure. I don't want to say that. It's just, you know, when I look at a film like this, it's too CGI heavy. Whereas my daughter loved it. And I think if people are looking for a family movie, stuck quarantined at home, you can probably do worse.
Well, as you mentioned, Matt, Buck seems to have these very human qualities. He does things that a dog probably wouldn't do, like hide the bottle from his master.
Yes,
you know?
Or save people under the ice. That is one of the more ridiculous sequences in the film, I must say.
Well, I did come up with a bit of an Oscar trivia question that actually surprised me when I was looking into the making of the movie and the star in it, Harrison Ford. Mm-hmm. Harrison Ford's Oscar history is intriguing to me, and that is because he's never won an Oscar.
No.
He was nominated once. Mm-hmm. What was that for?
That was for Witness in 1985. Do you want me to tell you the other nominees that year?
Well, go right ahead.
I could try. The winner was William Hurt, Kiss of the Spider Woman. We also had James Garner, I believe, in Murphy's Romance. I think John Voight, Runaway Train, is one of them that year. And then Jack Nicholson, Pritzi's Honor. That was 1985.
So one of the highest paid actors in movie history, Harrison Ford, doesn't have an Oscar.
There's got to be an honorary one coming, don't you think, Doug, within the next year or so?
He's had quite a history.
He's got to be high on the list, yeah.
Yes. Well, we've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Daybook for April 9th. On this date in 1974, there were no classes at Minnewaukan Public School. Although that Tuesday was not a holiday, nor a storm day, the students had the day off. The Minnewaukan Fire Department had lost its fire chief. And the Commercial Club, which promoted businesses in the area, the Quarterback Club, and the Presbyterian Church had all lost one of their hardest working members. One of Minnewaukan's most loved and most prominent citizens, Glenn Schmid, had passed away. The funeral was being held at the public school, since it was the largest venue in town. They put up folding chairs and pulled out bleachers to accommodate the large crowd. Mourners came from miles around to pay their respects to Norma, the widow of Glenn, and their four children. The crowd remembered Glenn, a man who was happy-go-lucky, smiling, always ready to tell a joke. Glenn had worked all his life at Schmid's You Save grocery store, where he was the manager. His mother, Hazel, was the owner. Glenn drew customers to the store not only for the groceries and top-quality cuts of meat, but for the ambiance, the atmosphere, and Glenn's jovial personality. The store had been a landmark on Minnewaukan's Main Street with its pressed tin ceilings and hardwood floors, big shop windows, and dirt-floored cellar. "City Market," Hazel would say when she answered the old black telephone in the large wooden counter. An old-fashioned cash register sat on the end of the counter, where Glenn or Hazel pressed the giant buttons and cranked a handle to deposit their earnings. Customers could purchase a dozen oranges for 79 cents, buy a Snickers bar for a dime, or just come in to chat. "Put it on my account," most customers would say. The Schmids knew most of the customers by name, and they weren't just customers, they were friends as well. The shop, as Hazel referred to it, managed to stay open a few more months after the passing of Glenn. But with no one there to manage the place, no one there to cut the large sides of beef, and with customers missing Glenn's laughter, the shop just wasn't the same. And Schmid's You Save closed its door after 70 years in business. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jill Whitcomb. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
With millions of people losing their jobs in recent weeks, there are now longer lines at the country's food banks. Charitable feeding programs are having trouble tracking down the produce that they need to meet the demand.
We're getting some of it. We're not getting enough of it.
And yet, at the same time, farmers are throwing out perfectly good food because they can't sell it. This country's food crisis on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow, our show is preempted as we carry a special from The Pulse as they dive deep into the mental health concerns surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.